Okay, I want to keep to a promise that we're going to keep to a prompt schedule. We are going to break around 11:45, 11:50 to grab lunch. I'll give instructions at the end. But I am shifting gears now to moderate this panel. As I said before, climate journalist. I've covered energy, climate politics, utilities, you name it, for over a decade. Was most recently at Vox, have reported for Mother Jones, Grist, and the New Republic, and also a governance chair for SCJ. The panel today, what we have here, is following the money trail of the clean energy transition. Where there's money involved, there's profiteers, there's people losing, there's consequences of that. We'll talk a lot about the changing stakes of the energy transition, particularly for utilities, and how important it is to understand their business models and how that intertwines with changing energy system. And we have a great panel here for you. So I will do brief introductions and then leave after some questions for me. We'll have ample time for the audience to ask their questions. So to my right, we have David Pomerantz. He's the executive director of Energy and Policy Institute, a watchdog organization that covers uncovers ways that electric and gas utilities block or slow down transition from fossil fuels. Previously, he spent 8 years working with Greenpeace and lives in Sonoma, California. Then we have Dan Giarino, a reporter for Inside Climate News covering the energy transition, often with a focus on Midwestern states. He came to ICN in 2018 after 9 years at the Columbus Dispatch. Emily Pontecorvo is a staff writer at Heatmap News, where she reports on policies, science, and market forces driving the energy transition. Previously, she was a staff writer for Grist, and she is based in New York City. I forgot to mention I live in Washington, D.C. So wanted to start, instead of having introductions from each speaker, just dive into some questions. So starting pretty high level, I wanted to ask Dave why you have to understand utility business models to understand clean energy and electrification. So Dave can give us a bit of a 101 on their business models.
Thanks, Rebecca. And yeah, thanks to SCJ for having me here and talking about this very important topic. It's really important to know how utilities make money. If you don't follow that regularly, it's not intuitive. So utilities are fundamentally different from any type of private company you've ever encountered. They have regulated monopolies, at least over their core business, which is distribution of energy. Those monopolies can extend to other things like generating energy, depending on the states. So this is a little bit different everywhere you look. But one thing that is kind of a base fact that's true across the country that's really important to understand what utilities' incentives and disincentives are with regard to the energy transition is that utilities make money by building stuff. So the term of art in the industry is CapEx or capital expenditures. If it helps to have some concrete examples of that, you could think of concrete or steel. So, like, when utilities build a physical asset, that's something that they're allowed to profit from. They don't actually profit, at least directly, from selling electrons or selling molecules of gas to their customers. You know, the more they sell, that can help them justify building more capital expenditures, and that's where the profit comes from. So there's a relationship there. But the way that they profit directly is by building stuff. And what that looks like in real practical terms is, unlike with companies that operate in more, I guess I would say, more normal markets or something closer to normal markets, utilities exactly how much money they profit is actually determined essentially by fiat, by their regulators, a group of people, a type of government body that we'll probably talk a fair amount about on this panel, which are public utility commissions. And so a public utility commission, it's a government panel. Sometimes it's three people, sometimes it's five people, sometimes it's seven people. There's about 200 of these people around the country. There's one in every state. They determine what a utility is allowed to spend on capital expenditures, like how much money they're allowed to spend, and the exact return on that spending that they're allowed to earn. So as a ballpark number, just to like help you get your head around some math, it's usually about 10%. So if a utility spends $1 billion building a new substation, power plants, electric lines, wind farms, gas plants, any of that stuff, they'll get a profit on that of like about $100 million, depending on what the regulator says. You know, it could be 9%, it could be 11%, and that number actually matters quite a lot. That one percentage point can make a huge difference, and we'll talk more about all that stuff. But I'll probably stop there rather than kind of go too deep into the finances now. I have a feeling we're going to come back to this, but it's so important to understanding kind of like where the money flows when it comes to these changing energy mixes we have and to whom it flows. Just as a last note on this kind of like how utilities profit question, it doesn't have to be this way. It's like a crazy, archaic way to do things. It's kind of the legacy of decisions that were made about 100 years ago when it really made a lot of sense that we wanted to incentivize utilities to build a lot of stuff. That context has probably changed pretty dramatically now, and there are some states that are experimenting with different ways to regulate how a utility makes money. But the existing way, this kind of sort of CapEx-based profit model, has made utilities incredibly wealthy and utility shareholders for investor-owned utilities incredibly wealthy, so they're pretty reluctant to explore other ways that they could make money that create tons of different incentive models. So that's a quick, not too quick, but relatively quick overview of how utilities make money.
That was very quick. This is really complicated stuff, so it's hard to condense it, and we can dig into more of that if the audience has questions. But next up, Dan, let's take this further of how these business models make some utilities opponents of clean energy and hinders electrification, taking that further from where Dave was giving the high-level discussion of business models.
All right. Can you all hear me okay? So one of the big – villain's not quite the right word, but one of the big villains when you try to explain a lot of what's wrong with the utility business model and why it at times does not serve the public interest is the role of Wall Street and the fact that these are publicly traded companies. And these are companies that are under pressure to grow their earnings. They are under pressure to say that in 2024 their profits, their earnings are higher than they were in 2023 and they're going to be higher in 2025. And if you are a CEO or top executive of one of these companies and you can consistently grow earnings, they're going to name buildings after you and you're going to be – you're golden. If you don't do that, you are going to lose your job. So the pressure to constantly grow earnings is a factor that runs headlong against so many of the imperatives of the energy transition. So for electrification to work, if we're going to take a bunch of the things that are today done with fossil fuels and we're going to use electricity for those things, you can't just electrify everything. You can't just electrify transportation and home heating and all those things without also doing a ton of energy efficiency work. You have to both grow the kind of list of the stuff that relies on electricity, but then you need to make existing stuff and new stuff a lot more efficient. Energy efficiency is, to a lot of utilities, this almost kind of kryptonite, because it's if you have programs or you have efforts within your community to get people to use less energy, that is taking away from the revenue that the utility is making. Now, there are all kinds of different policy approaches to try to make it so that you don't have this kind of perverse incentive to increase and to be inefficient, but it's really, really hard to do. Another important factor is that the corporate structures of these electricity companies, the electricity utilities, you'll see a bunch of electricity utilities that are also, they also have gas utility subsidiaries. So it's great for an electric company to have everyone using electricity. But if you're going to that kind of corporate, you know, retreat or something where there's the CEO of the gas subsidiary that's your kind of corporate cousin, and you say, oh, yeah, we want you to cease to exist, that doesn't go over very well. And there's a bunch of really big companies that are like that. Also, there are these long-term alliances, these kind of like coal companies that have long-term alliances with electricity utilities. These are their friends. These guys are used to lobbying for things in the legislatures. And they don't easily change, and they don't easily kind of take actions that would harm their friends. And I'll stop there for now.
Great transition, because my question for Emily is it's important not to group utilities into one big bucket. As Dan was talking about, there are often gas subsidiaries. And I hope you could talk just specifically to gas utilities of what electrification means for them.
Yeah. Can you guys hear me? Yeah. Okay. Doesn't seem like it's amplifying my voice, but I'm curious, just a show of hands, who has heard the phrase electrification is existential crisis for gas utilities? Great. Okay. I'm not sure, you know, coming into this room, like, I feel like that gets thrown around a lot, but I think that's at the core of this discussion, or at least what I'm going to talk about. If everyone's, you know, electrifying their heating and their stoves and all the appliances in their house, the gas utilities are left with no one to serve. And so I'll just add to that, it's also an existential crisis for the union workers that work for these gas companies. So not only are you, you know, in the conversation around electrification, are you talking about taking away this, you know, entire business, but you're also talking about, you know, potentially eliminating all these jobs. And so they're just another, like, you know, important stakeholder in this whole conversation. One thing I wanted to bring up is that when you talk to advocates who work on electrification policy, they're really worried about it, and not because they feel bad for gas utilities, but because there's a potential for this all to just get really, really messy. Right now we have, like, all of these subsidies and incentives that are encouraging people to, you know, electrify their homes. But right now it's still mostly wealthier people who can do that and take advantage of that. And as those people cut their gas lines and get off the system, there's still this, like, massive gas system for everyone else that needs to be maintained, and you start to have a smaller and smaller pool of customers who are all kind of sharing the cost of maintaining that system, which means all of their rates could, you know, go up dramatically. So that's what people are really worried about, and one thing you hear a lot is this idea that we need to have a managed decline of the gas system. And so I think a lot of the stories around, like, especially when we're talking about, like, gas and electrification and the Public Utility Commission, a lot of the stories are about, like, what does a managed decline look like? What are people testing out and trying? There's a lot of, like, pilot projects and different ideas being tested out around the country right now. And some gas utilities are kind of more open to experimenting than others. Let's see. I could keep going, but I'm not sure if I should.
You can keep going.
So I guess I'll maybe just talk about a couple of those ideas that people are talking about. There's, you know, one idea where you could potentially, like, try to electrify an area, like, block by block. So there are places where there are pilot projects for electrifying an entire neighborhood. then, you know, kind of similar to that, there's this idea that's gaining a lot of traction in a lot of different states called thermal energy networks. And this is a really interesting idea because it's being pitched as a way to kind of keep gas utilities in business, keep their workers employed. And basically, this is, I'll try to explain this as best as I can. I'm not an engineer. But you can install these geothermal heating systems in people's homes, and these are sort of like heat pumps. They run on electricity, but they use the kind of constant heat that's underground. They kind of you run pipes underground and use the heat from underground to kind of heat and cool your house. And basically, there's an idea that you can kind of network a whole bunch of these systems throughout a neighborhood, and by doing so, you gain a lot of efficiency. You kind of can bring down costs by installing all of this at once. And the idea is that if, you know, gas utilities have the capital to do that, and, you know, instead of managing pipes that run gas through a neighborhood, they could manage pipes that run water through a neighborhood. And so it's this sort of optimistic kind of utopian idea for the future of the gas utility is that they're managing these water pipes. And there actually are some projects where, you know, gas utilities are experimenting with this. So one really exciting one, the kind of pioneer of this idea, is in Massachusetts, in Framingham, where the utility Eversource is building a project right now, a network geothermal project. And interestingly, Eversource has left the American Gas Association, which I think is just an interesting data point, because the American Gas Association, I don't think, is really invested in this idea. They haven't, you know, as far as I know, been really exploring it. And so I think that shows that maybe Eversource is kind of taking it more seriously.
The trade group side of this is fascinating and a really big part of following the money. So maybe we'll also dig into that some more. But I think so far we're hearing a lot of how what's good for utilities is not necessarily the same as what's good for customers. And just to take a specific example of a story that a lot of people have grappled with is the headline that electric bills are going up. And what's to blame? There's a lot of these assumptions that solar and wind will decrease costs, or that it's responsible for driving bills up. We just see these competing headlines in the news. So, Dave, I wanted to hear how to not take certain assumptions here for granted, how does a reporter really navigate that big question of why are electricity bills going up?
That's a great question, and so I imagine most of you have some experience with rising electric bills in, you know, where you live and work. I live in PG&E service territory in California. PG&E kind of a notorious utility over the last couple of decades for starting wildfires and blowing up a big gas pipeline in San Bruno, California. Locally, what they're most notorious for right now probably is very, very, very high electric rates. So I think my on-peak rates right now, for folks who are familiar with electric rates, are like 40 cents a kilowatt hour on weekday peak. That's like three times what they are in many parts of the country. It's a little lower off-peak, but not enough to make the math work. And they're going up all the time. PG&E is in for a rate increase right now. When utilities want to raise rates, they have to go in front of that regulator that I mentioned before, the Public Utilities Commission. And this is for investor-owned utilities, which we should probably at least touch upon at some point, publicly owned utilities. Again, just by way of background, and for folks who I think work in more rural areas, you'll probably be more familiar with them. About 70% of the country is served by investor-owned electric utilities, the other third by a mix of cooperatively owned utilities, which are have boards that are elected by their customers. They're technically owned by their customers. They call their customers member owners. And municipal utilities. So I'm going to largely stick to talking about investor-owned utilities for now and how their rates are governed, but we may come back to the other kinds because they're an important part of this too. So when an investor-owned utility wants to raise rates, they go to the Public Utility Commission and they submit a number. They say, you know, this is what it costs to run the grid, and it costs, you know, $600 million more now than it did 3 years ago, the last time we were in for a rate increase, so we need you to approve that amount. And then there is a heavily litigated process around that in most states. So maybe I'll answer the last part of Rebecca's question first about how to cover rate increases. You've got to dig into the rate case. And for reporters, and I obviously am not a reporter, I'm an advocate, but we do some similar things to what reporters do. Rate cases are gold mines of information because they're heavily litigated. So in a rate case, it's kind of like if any of you have ever had to like file an expense report for your job, it's like the world's biggest expense report. So these are, you know, thousands of pages of Excel filings and testimony to explain the filings, basically saying it's the utility justifying what it costs to run the grid or to run the gas system. And then other parties, including often statutory parties like an attorney general, or other parties who hire legal counsel and, you know, have lawyers and participate in these cases, they get to ask questions of the utility under oath that they're supposed to answer, at least. Sometimes they don't. So, you know, that creates a really long paper trail, which is great for reporters. It takes a lot of deciphering, but there are, you know, people who are parties to those cases who, you know, have their own interests, but many of them represent the public interest, you know, or environmental interests or others, and typically are, you know, happy to help walk you through those filings, and certainly our organization dabbles in that too and are happy to help. Okay, that's how to cover rate increases. Why they're actually going up? Yeah, if you talk to people like me, climate advocates, environmental advocates, we have been promising for many years now, and more in every year, and even more now thanks to supportive federal policy, that wind and solar in most parts of the country are cheaper than coal and gas. Switching from coal and gas to wind and solar will lower electric bills. And then you also hear from, you know, people affiliated with the fossil fuel industry or, you know, just the parts of the political spectrum that have become more opposed to those renewable resources that know, in fact, wind and solar are super expensive and they're not reliable and you have to build all these other things to support them, and so actually they'll make the cost go up. And what's the actual answer to that? Well, some of it depends on every state. I'm going to give a couple overarching ideas here that I think are mostly true in most places. One thing is, this is an oversimplification, but broadly speaking, three things go into what customers pay for on their electric bills. Making the electricity, so that's the generation component of the bill. Transmission, which is like the really big wires, you know, this room probably knows all this stuff, but those are like, you know, the interstate highway system of electricity, and then the distribution grid, which is like the local wires to bring electricity right up to people's front doors. Most of people's electricity bills is in the transmission and distribution part. And in almost all parts of the country, that is the part of the bill that's growing fastest. So one way to answer to this question is that this whole question of, you know, renewables versus gas, coal, et cetera, that's like a third of the bill. And in some cases, it's less, and that number is shrinking. Then beyond that, you know, it is true that the renewable resources, just if you're looking at the resources, are cheaper than coal everywhere now. They're cheaper than gas in many places. It's also true that, you know, as you get to really high penetrations of renewable energy, you do need more transmission. You do need some, you know, you need battery storage. You need some of those other things. You need, you know, lots of those things for the gas system as well. In a lot of the recent increases that people have felt most pointedly on their bills in recent years, if you're looking at the generation portion of the bill, have been due to very, very volatile prices of methane gas or natural gas. And that's due to the fact that the U.S. made a policy decision in 2015 to export LNG, which exposes our relatively cheaper gas to global markets. So it makes gas more expensive here. And there's a war in Europe, and that has also made methane gas much more volatilely priced. So there are places where, you know, in fact, pretty much everywhere in the country in the last couple of years, electric bills have gone up to reflect that, those gas price hikes. They come back down in some cases when the price of gas comes down, but there's a lag, and that stuff can be hard to decipher. There are places where, like, there are some places where the answer to this question is really clear. So in West Virginia, that they've had the highest rate of growth in electric bills in the country recently. Not the highest bills. My state, sadly, owns that title along with Hawaii, but the highest rate of increase. And that's because of policy decisions that the West Virginia Public Service Commission and West Virginia legislature has made to keep very uneconomic coal plants online, and that's actually pretty clear. But in other places, it's different. The last thing I'll say is, like, all this conversation, you know, around the energy transition and what effect it will have on electric bills. Does it make bills go up? Does it make bills go down? I think it's kind of actually missing the more important relationship between climate change and people's electric bills, which is how the actual climate change itself is driving up electric bills, not the transition that's a response to climate change. So one of the biggest driver of electric bill increases in California is the massive amounts of money that the state's utilities have had to spend on wildfire mitigation. And, you know, in Louisiana, a big thing driving up bills for ratepayers of Entergy, which is an electric utility down there, is grid hardening that they need to do to spend on hurricane response and rebuilding grids there. Less more to say about this, but I'm sure Dan and Emily have thoughts to add, too.
Emily, you want to jump in?
I just want to jump in really quick and just say one thing. One of the first things Dave said was that rate cases are a gold mine, and I was going to bring this up before, but very much encourage everyone, if you're looking for sources on these topics or if you're looking to just kind of understand what's going on in your state on these topics, go to your utility commission's website, open up a docket, any docket, electricity docket, gas docket, and just look through some of the comments, and you'll find, you know, which local groups are kind of involved in this case, like which environmental groups are kind of advocating on this issue. A lot of times those groups will also hire outside experts and consulting firms to weigh in on the questions at stake, and so you can get their names and call these other experts. And also, it may seem overwhelming, but once you start looking at these documents, they're actually pretty easy to understand. They often will summarize, like, all of the kind of main issues at the top of the document, so you can kind of get up to speed very quickly. So just highly recommend you spend some time in your utility commission's rate cases.
Thank you. And we wanted to make this even more concrete for you. So Dan put together a quick presentation on just deciphering an electricity bill. So, Dan, take it away.
All right. And I will second the docket diving. Oh, my Lord. It's like, I swear, it was like my eyes were open. And then once you get really good at it, you can just, the things you can find, especially old docketed items, you can find the time that a utility promised they would do something within 10 years, 10 years ago, and you can ask them, well, how's that going? And they'll be like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And it's like, but yeah, so dockets are great. Okay, so I'm going to talk to you about a bill for American Electric Power. That's my utility in Columbus, Ohio. So I put in, you can go to this website, and you can download a rate spreadsheet. Rate spreadsheets are a gold mine or finding story ideas. And I know that might sound ridiculous, but just bear with me. So for this, I plugged in April 2024, and the electricity usage is 500 kilowatt hours. So that's kind of like a small residential, maybe kind of typical residential in a lot of places. And we are looking at RR bundle, which basically means typical residential customer. So what is in there? So if you just plug the numbers in, you get this utterly incomprehensible thing. And this is different from what's on your bill. On your bill is, like Dave was talking about, transmission, distribution, generation, and you might have a couple other special categories. But baked into all of those things are all of these other categories. And this spreadsheet explains down to the penny how they arrive at what those things are. Okay, so what's in there? Okay. My total bill in this case, $118.83. First of all, customer charge, it's a flat fee of $10. There is this whole area of utility litigation about raising customer charges. It is, it's fascinating. I'm not going to go off on a tangent about it. It's called the straight fixed variable. So if you Google that, you can see the, basically utilities want to make that really, really high so that people who are really good at not using very much electricity, it's also a real anti-rooftop solar thing. But right now AEP has just a $10 flat fee. So, second thing, the energy charge. So the energy charge plus that flat fee I just showed you, those two things together make up what AEP calls base charges. At one time, the base charges were supposed to be just about everything you needed to be able to deliver electricity. The energy charge is based on how much energy you use. The flat fee, of course, is just, it's the same no matter how much energy you use. Third thing is something called the Universal Service Fund. This is low-income programs. So for this customer, they paid $2.96. This funds bill assistance for people who can't afford to pay it. Now, right now, so far, we've been, this is kind of fairly vanilla stuff, but it starts to get weird here pretty quick. Okay, kilowatt-hour tax, that's pretty self-explanatory. Generation energy rider, pretty straightforward. This is the generation portion of the bill. This is paying the power plants that give you your electricity. Generation capacity rider, this is one of those things that there's a story in there. And I cut and pasted the official explanation within the spreadsheet of what they say this is. And just, if you like gobbledygook, just give that a read. Basically, AEP is charging you for the cost of participating in this regional market. And this is a process. They were allowed to do this charge because it was approved by the state commission. And this is one of those charges that deserve scrutiny and has been pretty heavily litigated at the commission. Legacy Generation Resource Rider, $1.47. Oh, man. Now we're getting to the stuff that has put people in jail. So this is a charge that pays for several utilities that co-own a coal-fired power plant in Ohio, and they also own a coal-fired power plant in Indiana. This is a charge that was a gift from the legislature, and they can basically guarantee a profit at those plants, even though Ohio's system for power plants requires that power plants are subject to competitive pressures. They shouldn't be able to get a guaranteed profit. So it's this special carve-out, including a plant in Indiana. So one of the key people behind this is former House Speaker Larry Householder, who is now incarcerated. And this is one of those charges that you could write all day about those plants, how you got this charge, why the charge is still there. And the reason the charge is still there is a bunch of really big utilities want it. And the legislature or the Public Utilities Commission are not going to get rid of it. This is their, you know, again, the gobbledygook explanation of what the Legacy Generation Resource Rider is. I'm going to just skip right by that because that's not in English. Okay, Basic Transmission Cost Rider, just like David was saying, this has gone up a lot. Used to be the transmission portion of your bill was not that big. Now it's $21.92. That's a lot for an AEP Ohio customer. That's because the utilities have determined that transmission is easy to get approved. These big projects, when I say easy to get approved, there are obviously challenges getting these projects approved. But this is a way that they can make money, and the returns on equity that they get, the profit that they get from these projects, is usually higher than the stuff that they do within the state. This is a big, like, flashing, you want to know why your bills are going up, this. Economic development cost recovery, gold mine right here. This is money that the utility has negotiated with companies to give them discounts on their electricity. These are factories. This makes money for the utility. This is a giveaway for those companies. And they have to file something every year that says where all that went and who got it. And it's their stories in there. Enhanced service reliability. This is basically tree trimming. Tree trimming that they make roughly a 10% profit on. Now, way back in the day, the tree trimming was part of those base charges I started out with. Now they get this whole extra charge, and we're not even done. Grid Smart Phase 2 Rider. Okay, the smart grid. Smart grid is a term you hear thrown around a lot. The way the utilities implement this, it is a great opportunity to spend a lot of money on equipment and to get that 10% profit. And the ways that they actually implement it is often, it's not super impressive. It's almost as if the kind of obtaining of earnings was front and center, and having a smarter system that actually better serves customers was not necessarily front and center. We're almost done, but just a couple more. Distribution Investment Rider. This is another, kind of like the tree trimming, this is to spend more money to kind of harden the distribution system, to make it so that the lines are a little bit better able to deal with all kinds of issues. This is a real giveaway. This is a $4.96 in a residential bill. If you spread that out over an entire utility territory, that's a ton of money. That's like half of the base charge, the customer fee. And this is just, again, something that at one time they would have done just with those base charges. Storm Damage Recovery Rider. When you have a storm and they have to recover from it, even if that storm is because they had a poorly maintained system, they get to charge you for it, and they make a profit off of that. It's $1.26. Alternative Energy Rider. Okay. This is what they say about the Alternative Energy Rider. This is another legacy of the things that led to people being incarcerated. I'm going to just leave it at that. But there's a whole backstory there. Tax Savings Credit Rider. Thank you, Donald Trump. This is from the 2017 tax bill. It led to utility savings, which they passed on to customers. 12 cents. I mean, I'm feeling richer. Solar Generation Fund Rider. Now, this is my favorite explanation yet. It's only 10 cents. Solar Generation Rider. This rider is to fund disbursements to qualifying solar resources as required by the General Assembly. They created this incentive that is barely used when they got rid of a much bigger program that was paying for renewable energy. So this is kind of what the clean energy policy is in Ohio now, this thing that is just 10 cents. Last thing, energy efficiency and peak demand cost recovery, zero. Ohio got rid of its energy efficiency programs. So this thing that is one of the most important things that utility can do and should do, it's still on your bill. There's just no charges for it because the energy efficiency programs have been eliminated. Grand total again, that's how we got to $118.83. Thanks.
Thank you, Dan. learned a lot there. We're talking a lot about utility businesses and consumer end. I do want to shift gears a bit to talk about the policy and programs and how to track the funding there, because we have the IRA and direct consumer rebates that are coming at some point in the future and already tax breaks that are underway. So, Emily, hope you could just give us a sense where things stand and what are some tips for, as these programs are implemented, of actually tracking them.
Yeah, okay. So I'll start by saying the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, it's kind of confusing. And you may have heard this, but there's a lot of polling showing that Americans really have no idea what it is or what's in it, which is bad because we have this one shot where we have, like, billions of dollars to help people with this energy transition, and, like, if people don't know that it's there, then they won't take advantage of it. attention to the money that's available and help your readers, you know, understand what's available. So with the IRA, and I'm going to be just talking about kind of your house and electrification, there's kind of two different types of funding. There's tax credits and rebates. Tax credits are available now. People can be claiming them as early as, I think, last year or even maybe 2022. And there's one for solar and batteries. You can get a 30% tax credit for installing solar and batteries. There's kind of a separate bucket for things like heat pumps and insulation and new windows and doors. And these are, like, people can claim them every year. You can get, like, up to $3,000, $3,200 every single year for the next, like, decade to help you pay for this stuff. So that's out there. There's that. But as some of us may know, tax credits are a little bit hard to take advantage of. Not everyone has tax liability. It's ultimately not a ton of money to help. Some of, like, you know, for heat pumps, you can get about $1,000 in tax credits, and heat pumps can cost anywhere from $15,000 to $20,000 to $30,000. So it's not enough. There's also rebates, and a lot of states and even local governments and utilities already offer rebates. So there's already this sort of whole, you know, group of incentives out there that people in your state might have access to. I think that once the Inflation Reduction Rebate programs start to roll out, which they have not yet, I think it'll start to, like, kind of change the landscape for rebates a little bit. But what's happening right now is states had to apply for this money, and you can actually, I wanted to share, so far only 12 states have even submitted their applications for this money. So we're pretty behind on this program. You can go to energy.gov/save/rebates, and I can share that with you later if you didn't catch that. But you can actually see a map of which states have applied, kind of the status of their application. I think that's just a helpful resource to know about. And I was actually told earlier this year that, you know, of the states that did get their applications in early, like I think New York is one of them, we probably won't see any of that money actually available to consumers until at least the end of this year. So I think there's, like, a little bit of accountability story in there, because, you know, it's been, that'll be almost 2 years since the Inflation Reduction passed, and this promised big pot of money to help people electrify, like, we've kind of wasted 2 years to use it. But so there's that. I think I'd also recommend, as this, you know, kind of put this in your pocket for later, because I don't think this is necessarily relevant until these rebate programs start to roll out, but there are other federal programs that help with this stuff. So there's the Weatherization Assistance Program. There's something called LIHEAP. And those are similar, where, you know, states apply to the federal government for money, and they've kind of had these programs in place for a long time. But those programs have evolved a little bit, and they can help people pay for some aspects of electrification. So I'm very interested in how will the sort of intermediaries that you know, between the homeowners and the people who distribute this funding, so kind of state energy offices and contractors, how are they going to, like, weave these funding sources together and help people navigate, like, all there's all these, like, different funding sources, and different people are eligible for different ones, and some of them are geared at low-income people or moderate-income people, and so just digging into that a little bit. One other set of resources that I think are helpful if you are interested in this stuff is Rewiring America is a national nonprofit focused on electrification, and they have this, I can't think of the name of it off the top of my head, it's like called an electrification planner.
They have some kind of, like, toolkit. I'm not sure if it's an actual, I think they have a calculator, but they also have these PDFs that just, like, show you what you can do in your home and what programs are associated.
Yeah. So, well, they have this personal electrification tool where you can actually, I'm pretty sure you can, like, enter in your zip code and, like, maybe some information about what type of house you live in, and it kind of walks you through, like, what rebates and tax credits may be available to you. So I think that's just a good – it's helpful for homeowners, but I think it's also helpful for journalists to just kind of, you know, get a sense of it. Another kind of upcoming thing is Rewiring America is working with a bunch of other groups on creating this very comprehensive tool where you'll be able to put in your zip code and get a list of all the incentives that are available to you. And that's going to be huge because that doesn't exist today. Like, there's really no way to just, like, be like, you know, if I live in Philadelphia, like, what are all the possible pots of money that I could get help from to electrify my home? And so they're going to have a tool that actually, like, gets down to, like, the utility level, the local level, the state level, the federal level.
Yeah. So
that's really exciting.
Thank you. So want to just dig in one level further, specifically into rooftop solar, because this is something that's so disruptive to the utility model. But Dan, you wrote this great piece, I think recently, on these economic tipping points where rooftop solar really starts to make sense for the consumer. And this came up on the earlier panel, just how rooftop solar talk about the costs is based on these somewhat outdated talking points. So are we approaching that tipping point, or are we past it?
Yeah, we're very close. There are different terms for this point. And, of course, it kind of varies where you are. But the key variables to pay attention to, and this builds nicely on other things we've talked about, utilities just can't help themselves. They are raising rates like crazy because they feel a pressure to grow earnings. So as utility rates go up, the cost of rooftop solar went down a lot for a long time. It's kind of flattened out at this point, but the dynamic, as I see it right now, is that rooftop solar costs are flat-ish, and utility rates keep going up. So that means in the states like California, where utility rates are just insane, you save money. You can buy a rooftop solar system, and you can pay it off with your bill savings. Despite there are different policy levers they've pulled to make it not as quick as it used to be, but still, it's financially advantageous. But it's not just California anymore. That's also true in Illinois. It's true in Michigan. It's true in, you know, again, depending on how you want to frame the economics and depending on what you consider to be a reasonable payoff period, you could say that it's true in close to half of the country right now. And again, because utilities cannot help themselves, this is going to continue to kind of spread to more places. Utility rates will get higher, and someone will just say, my goodness, you know, rooftop solar looks like a better deal now than it did 2 years ago because my electricity bill is just killing me. So this is what we're going to see for the next 5 years, 10 years. You're going to just watch this becoming more and more so. You'll see solar gaining a foothold in more and more markets. You also see this recurring theme of utilities fighting back, trying to make solar more expensive, trying to add special charges, trying to change policies. If this is subject matter you're interested in, I would encourage you just to really familiarize yourself with the regulatory dockets on this stuff in your state, because it's fascinating, and it's something that this battle has not been settled. It's going to only intensify in the near future.
Great. Well, I want to leave a lot of time for questions. We've covered a lot of ground, and there's a lot more to discuss. So just a reminder to please identify yourself, that journalists and SCJ members are prioritized for asking questions. Please phrase it in the form of a question rather than a statement. Right in front.
My question is,
I'll just quickly paraphrase. I assume not everyone could hear the question. So the question was about how IRA funds and new programs can integrate with existing energy assistance programs like LIHEAP. So
the answer is I don't know. I was bringing that up as something that I hope we all start to look into because I think it's important. I you know, when I've talked to people in the past before the IRA passed, I've spoken to there are like, you know, these kind of local nonprofits and groups that help, that already exist to help people navigate programs like the Weatherization Assistance Program and LIHEAP. And even those people struggle to, like, weave together the funding from weatherization assistance, LIHEAP, utility rebates. Like, it's already a confusing process. And so I'm very interested in, like, what is the putting the IRA on top of that do, especially because the rebates in the IRA are, there's two different kinds, but at least one of them is very specifically geared towards low and moderate income people. So I'm just curious how that is going to interact with those programs. I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer.
I want to follow up on that. This is probably best for Dave, that the IRA is also this boondoggle for utilities. So if you could unpack some of that, because we were talking more about energy assistance side and direct-to-consumer rebates, but this is also a way for utilities to profit.
Yeah, I would say it's at risk of being a boondoggle for utilities. It doesn't have to be. The IRA and also the IIJA, the bipartisan infrastructure law, is often also called, does make a lot of money eligible for utilities to spend on certain things, and what they spend it on and how they spend it and whether they're additionally allowed to use, you know, invest more of their capital that they earn a profit on, that will all ultimately be determined by a public utility commission. Kind of like one theme of all this is all roads lead back to the public utility commission sooner or later. And so I'll give you an example. Like there are some DOE grants that utilities are eligible for that they can spend on, you know, sort of on, like, the grid, on grid hardening, on, you know, making the grid more reliable, adding substations or more infrastructure where it's needed. And that's a good thing. Like, to be clear, our electricity grid, and particularly the transmission system, like, pretty desperately needs investment. That's an area where, as a utility watchdog, I probably would agree with most utilities, and that there's a cost to that. Some of these federal laws that passed now a couple years ago create big pools of taxpayer funds to fund some of that investment, and that is good. That is a more progressive way, this is my opinion here, obviously, but that's a more progressive way, like, nationally to fund needed grid investments than because we, you know, federal income tax system is at least progressive relative to people's electricity bills, which are incredibly regressive, right? So it's good that that money is available, but because of the, you know, the shareholder pressure that utilities are under that Dan mentioned, a utility is going to take that money and say, okay, here's maybe $200 million from federal taxpayers that we can get in a DOE grant to spend on grid hardening. We're going to take that and we're going to say to our Public Utilities Commission, okay, we'll use that. And look, we'll add, you know, $300 million of ratepayer money. This is a good deal. It's like a public, you know, public money incenting more private money. It's a good deal for taxpayers, good deal for ratepayers. And we're going to spend it on, you know, these grid hardening programs. That's all fine to that point in theory. And then the question is, like, how are they actually spending the money? And is it actually accruing to ratepayers' benefit, or is it, to come back to Rebecca's word, potential boondoggle, right? So Dan was talking about sort of smart grid infrastructure before. Smart grid, that became a, I think utilities did some polling and focus grouping on the word smart about a decade ago and found out people really like it. They like smart grids and they like smart meters and they like all their utility infrastructure to be smart, and they've pretty much used it ever since.
Yeah, back to the theme of like language, being careful. Yeah. Sulfur.
And so, smart meters are an actual thing that you might come across if you if you're covering utility issues. They're basically like, you know, Wi-Fi enabled electric meters instead of the old kind that feel like cranked analog. Utilities love smart meters because they're a big capital investment that they can make and get a big return on. But if they don't pair them with smart rates and smart billing practices, what they basically are is a way for utilities to disconnect customers for non-payment on the cheap because they don't have to send a truck around to do it manually, which costs more money that they don't actually earn a profit on. So, like, you really kind of have to dig into the weeds in how a utility is spending its, you know, a fairly large pot of federal money that's become available to them to say, are they using this as a way to increase their profits? And there's not necessarily anything wrong with that, but is it also creating benefit for ratepayers? And are there maybe better ways to spend that money that will create more benefit for ratepayers? Again, all decisions that are going to, I promise you, in your public utility commission, someone is fighting about that right now, and so it's just a question of trying to find that docket and unearth those stories.
Great. The person in the back there? I'll just briefly paraphrase that. The question was, do any public utility commissions set limits on rate increases, or what would it take to set them? And a few examples in the Northwest on utility bills increasing by a lot.
I would just, my own experience writing about rate caps, yes, so you can have some sort of either statutory, the legislature passes it, or a commission can have a rate cap. Rate caps, though, it often ends very poorly. The utility's going to get paid. And a lot of times if there's a rate cap, they'll collect whatever they say their true costs were plus interest later on. And there's this whole litigation about how to calculate the cost of capital. And it's, in my experience observing rate caps, it's better in terms of the public interest to it doesn't seem to work very well.
I'll give a couple of states as interesting examples. So one along the lines of what Dan mentioned, which is a really good point. In Virginia in 2015, they passed a law. I would probably not call it a rate cap, but a rate freeze. This is something that the monopoly dominant electric utility there, Dominion Energy, asked for, and that should be your first tell that why would a utility ask for a rate freeze? The reason is if there were a well-adjudicated rate case in Virginia at that time, rates would have gone down. So they were freezing rates from decreasing rather than increasing, which is a clever little turn of phrase. That rate freeze lasted, I believe, for 6 or 7 years until, I think, 2022. Maybe somebody in the audience can correct me on that. But during that time, I know this is going to sound crazy, like even listening to myself, like I can't believe that this happened. They froze base rates, but they added a bunch of what are called riders to the bills. So people's bills continued to rise. And so that's just a way of saying, like, Dan's right, you kind of got to watch out for, like, I mean, you all are naturally skeptical reporters. If the rate freeze proposal is coming from the utility, probably fair to take a good hard look at that. There are proposals to do this in ways that the utility wouldn't like, which is an indicator that at least the motives are pure of the people behind them. This is, again, I think something people here probably know more about for sure in the audience. Maybe Emily does. There's big omnibus energy legislation being debated in New York right now that I don't know what the odds are of the whole thing passing or this particular clause, but there's a portion in there that would cap bills or cap bills for I believe low income customers at 6% of their income. Is it 3? Oh, okay. So even more. Okay. There's a cap on the table in New York. Certainly the utilities oppose that. Otherwise, by and large, and I've heard of legislative proposals to prohibit utilities from raising rates faster than inflation. I don't believe that's on the books anywhere, and it would be very tough to pass over utilities' objections. The last thing I'll add is, like, typically it's done via individual rate cases, and there are cases, although very few and far between, where commissions have outright denied rate increases. So I guess one little bit of context that's important, because I think I see reporters particularly who are maybe a little newer to utility beats, not always know this context. There's kind of a game that gets played where utilities ask for, when they go in for a rate increase, they kind of ask for twice what they need. Then there's a negotiated settlement where they get half, and everybody gets to claim a win. The commission says, we cut the utilities rate increase by half. Public advocates get to claim a win, and the utility says, we've been sort of chastened here, and then they go back to Wall Street and say, we got everything we needed. So be wary of that. But there are cases, and I think the most fascinating story of this playing out in real time is in Connecticut, where the Public Utility Commission in Connecticut is doing many things at once. One of the things they're trying to do is move to a performance-based incentive model that sort of changes utilities' profit incentive. There's a reformer at the helm of that commission. And among other things, they basically just kind of flatly denied a rate increase instead of, the more typical outcome where the utility gets 50 or 60% of what it asked for. I think they got about 5 to 10% of what they asked for.
Yeah.
Sorry. There's been a lot of political blowback to that decision.
Yeah, we can talk on this a while. Yeah, so a lot more questions. I'm trying to call on people who haven't been called on yet. Right there? Yeah. You. Sorry. I was pointing black shirt. Yeah. Yes. Yes, thanks so much for bringing this back up. Different models of ownership. So this is talking about publicly owned utilities as opposed to privately.
This is probably, I can answer this one.
Go for it.
Okay. City-owned utilities are great for a reporter because they're subject to FOIA. You can get stuff. Like if there's some boondoggle of a power plant that a whole bunch of different people signed up for chunks of, and you find that there was a municipal utility that was one of the people signing up for it, great. You can go there. You can actually get the contract. You can so for in terms of how do you cover them, covering a city-owned utility is just so much easier. Their rates tend to be lower. It's partly because they have a higher population density. There's plenty of examples of poorly run city utilities, so I don't want to make it sound like this is great. I would say the opportunities, the universe of stories you can do about a city-owned utility to really get deep into what's going on is wider because of the fact that a lot of this stuff can be FOIA.
Great. Next question. The person right here? Yes.
Okay, great. My name is Alejandro, and I just had a question more about how fossil fuel companies use
Yeah. And can you just ID your association?
Oh, I'm CalMatters.
Okay, great. The question is on the fossil fuel industry, which is a great one. I feel like, Emily, you look excited to take this on.
I was trying to look at Dave.
Oh, well, Dave is also would be great.
Yeah, I'll try to be a little briefer with this one. This is kind of like a, maybe, I don't know, this may be a distinction without a difference. I think of gas utilities as fossil fuel companies until kind of one of them steps up to prove otherwise. Emily was talking about some of the companies who are closest to considering reform, like Eversource. I think my jury's out on that. I think they're doing that with, like, a regulatory gun to their head, essentially. I'd certainly look at how gas utilities are obviously heavily engaged by PUCs. That's their prime regulator. You do see fossil fuel companies further upstream sometimes get involved here. So American Petroleum Institute does try to sort of show up in the Public Utility Commission space sometimes, mostly to fight ratepayer investments on electric vehicle infrastructure, which makes sense given, they represent oil producers. There have been some incredible stories. I don't think the people who've reported them are in this room, but I know they're SEJ members, on how coal interests have paid for front groups to in Indiana, Michigan, Arkansas, possibly other states to create new entities out of whole cloth for the purpose of intervening in public utility commissions to fight against the closure of coal plants that burn the coal mined by the companies who pay for these front groups. So the most notable example of this, great kudos to the Indianapolis Star and NPR who did great reporting on this a few years ago. It was Wyoming Powder River Basin coal producers who were paying this guy to set up AstroTurf organizations to actually fight the utilities who wanted to close uneconomic coal plants that burn Powder River Basin coal. And just the way that they uncovered that story was some of the money was actually coming from the state of Wyoming and I think Gillette County, Wyoming, where the Powder River Basin is located. So public records requests and FOIA were a useful tool there.
Great.
I'll just add one quick thing, and I don't think this is very relevant in California, unfortunately, but I will say that in a lot of states, over the past several years, we've seen all of these, like, bills that show up that preempt local governments from kind of making decisions about their energy. So a lot of these bills, I know Rebecca has covered this, like, basically prevent a local city or town from passing an ordinance that says we want to ban, like what happened in Berkeley, we want to ban natural gas in new buildings. Just how this connects back to the fossil fuel industry is there's been cases where, like, the fossil fuel industry is lobbying for those policies at the state level where they're, you can kind of trace the money of campaign donations to certain sponsors of the bills, or that an organization like AGA may, like, have a sort of model bill that they've written and provided to the legislators, and then the legislation passes this kind of blanket preemption law that kind of takes away the power from local governments to start to try to make decisions about this stuff.
Yeah, the preemption bills are really important, and I think the only reason we're not seeing this at the federal level is administration. If there are a change of political winds, we might see more of these bills popping up there, too. Woman in front had hand up for a while.
Thank you.
Yeah, I rent. So the question is it's about renters, right? How to make this relevant. I rent. I don't know how many people up here rent. Yeah, I do think that's actually, it's a bit absent from the discussion, and the policies themselves are not always, are, there's a lot in IRA that makes the assumption and it's geared towards homeowners. That doesn't mean there's nothing, but, Emily or Dan, I feel like you're equipped to talk about this.
Okay. In the IRA, I think I don't, there's not a lot for renters in the IRA. I mean, there is a lot of money for multifamily building retrofits, but I don't know that that's something that, you know, an individual can really, like, gain from a story about that, although, so that's in the rebates, and so I would say, like, think about that again in a year, because once those rebates are out and that money is available, like, I think people should be pressuring their landlords or their city officials to pressure their landlords to take advantage of that money to retrofit these apartment buildings.
And energy efficiency is probably the area that would affect renters more rather than doing a major. There's a lot smaller things you can do on energy efficiency to make a difference.
Yeah. I'd also just quickly, like, there are some things renters can do. You can get, like, a induction hot plate, like things like that, like are eligible for rebates and tax credits. Like a window heat pump, which is kind of a newer product, but it's coming onto the market now. I just in terms of your other question of, like, how do we get people to care about this? How do we make this more interesting? Like, why do you have to know what's in your utility bill? Like, why should you follow these, like, very esoteric rate cases? I think, like, it's so important to keep emphasizing in these stories that this matters because the cost of the energy transition matters. Like, your utility bill and your utility commission, like, that's where the energy transition is taking place. Like, that's where these big decisions are being made and decisions about the cost of it are being made. And I know Dave said, like, you know, the real important thing is the cost that climate change has, like, on our bills. And that's true, but I think there's also this idea that if the energy transition is expensive and is perceived as this thing that's just, like, forced on consumers and drives up their bills, then there could be major backlash, and that could slow things down a lot more.
I think we could take one quick question. Let's see. Over there? Sorry. I was calling on you, but
it has to be
a quick question.
You guys have to break for lunch here, like, in a minute.
Okay.
Otherwise,
well, we can wrap up. I'm getting cut off here. Okay. If you can make it brief. Dave, you want to take that briefly?
I can. It's really hard to compare across countries because the energy systems are so, so different. If I could give the highest level thing I could say that I think is typically relevant, it's that underlying all of this conversation about the energy transition, and by the way, this was true before this current energy transition. It's always been true. Underlying all of it is politics. Like, there are people who stand to make money, people who stand to lose money, and this is a highly regulated field where people will spend a lot of money to get the outcomes that they want. I think that's true pretty much everywhere when you're talking about the scale of infrastructure that's required to generate and transmit and distribute electricity and gas and other forms of energy. So, there's none of this is even things that seem purely technical, there's politics underlying all of it.
Thank you. I know there's a lot we didn't get to. I think most of us are fine with sticking around for a little bit. Sorry to volunteer you, but okay, we're going to break for lunch. But try to hustle out there. Bring your food right back. We're going to start again at noon. Thank you.
We didn't do a proper round of applause.
Good afternoon, everybody. Hi. Hope you're all enjoying the conference so far. My name is Christy Swartz. I'm an investigative reporter with Floodlight. I rarely see my colleagues, and so we met yesterday for an all-day session, and that was really great. So Carl and I did some planning on Monday, and we agreed that we could talk about this topic for 3 days. So just settle in and grab some coffee. No, and I know that you all really don't wanna hear from me, but I'm gonna set the stage by saying we're actually both stuffed up. I run through all the Kleenex in my room, and why is that? It's because I live in Atlanta, and Atlanta right now is yellow because it's covered in pollen. And pollen has always been a thing, but as we've noticed, because of this thing called climate change, spring is coming earlier, and people who don't get impacted by allergies are now getting hit. And so a lot of us here are stuffed up. So I think that sets the stage for what we're here to talk about now. This number's been tossed around that we're kind of going through a 100-year evolution or revolution in the electric utility industry, and it's kind of happening all at once. And so what does that mean? I mean, that's actually changing the shape of the power grid. It's changing the infrastructure. It's changing the type of electricity that's going on the power grid. It's changing how these electric companies do business. And if you've all checked your power bill lately, or if you haven't, I'm sure everybody's paying a little bit more for one reason or another, but typically it's because of a confluence of five or six things. I know in the last panel they went through a bill line by line. I'm sure that was pretty fascinating. So what is going on right now? There's this big push to electrify everything, because that's one way to get more clean energy on the grid. There's also other reasons for that. And the industry itself is going through a period where they didn't have to build a lot of power plants, and they didn't have to add a lot of different things to the power grid for demand. But we are now in what they're calling kind of this historic era where we've got gobs of data, we've got AI, we've got crypto, and all of these things are driving up electricity demand to an all-time high. So what are they doing? They're going in and they're saying we need to build more and we need to add more. But then, of course, what type of fuel is that? How does that get on the grid? What does this mean for the United States clean energy goals? What does this mean for the global clean energy goals? So it's a very simple topic. Right? It's something we can get through in 5 minutes, right? No. So I'm really looking forward to having this conversation. Why don't we set the stage and kind of talk about the overarching problem or issue here that we're trying to solve, and then flow from there. Oh, yes. You know, it'd be good to always introduce, like, the person who's sitting there. This is a guy that I found on the street. No, I'm sorry. Dr. Hausker, I will have you go ahead and introduce yourself really quickly, and then we'll get into the main thing.
Sure, very glad to be here. Hello, everyone. I'm Carl Hausker. I'm a senior fellow at the World Resources Institute. Many of you are probably familiar with our work. We're one of the world's largest environmental think tanks working on all aspects of sustainability, including most prominently climate and energy, which is where I do my work. I've been at this 30 years. That's why I'm so depressed. And I'm also about 2 weeks behind Christy in the allergy season, but it's starting to move up north, and I'm just 2 weeks behind you. I just came off of 2+ years working as an expert reviewer for the IPCC 6 assessment process, reviewing Work Group 3, the mitigation report. But I also, so that makes my head explode, because to work on that, you have to know something about all 6 gases, all sectors, and how they all fit together, and it's beyond any human capability. But I survived. My deepest sectoral expertise is electricity, and that's, of course, what we're going to focus on today. And building on what Christy said, climate change requires a lot of solutions. Again, 6 gases, multiple sectors, domestic, international implications, has to be played at all levels of government, local, state, national, regional, global. But if I were to say there is one key battle on which our ability to solve climate change is going to hinge on, is can we produce a lot more electricity and squeeze all the carbon out of the generation system worldwide? Why? Because the single most important component of reducing greenhouse gas emissions is reducing the burning of fossil fuels and substituting the direct use of electricity for that combustion. And where we don't do that, use clean electricity to produce hydrogen or other synthetic fuels, there's other things we can do. And yes, we have to address methane, and yes, there's a bunch of other things, but I really believe this is the key battle. Doubling or even tripling global electricity production over the next 30 years while also reducing its emissions to near zero. So that's why we're focusing on electricity today.
So, Carl, we spent a lot of time talking about this. We kind of feel like looking at this path, or what you were telling me, is that, well, if we look, we've got, you know, the Biden administration that, with that and with Congress, came out with the IRA, which many people are saying is like the biggest climate bill that has happened in decades. So that's helping move this nation forward. Now, you have states, which basically is a patchwork of everybody wanting to do their own thing. Some states have more aggressive goals. Some clearly are pushing back. Some are pushing back because they're saying, you can't tell me what to do. Some are pushing back because fossil fuels are the root of their economy, and there's a real business reason there. Some are pushing back for other reasons. But one of the things I really want to get at is, we talked about kind of these two camps or these two paths that take a look at clean energy, and they're kind of in these two buckets.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and we should mention the third camp, which is still, there's too many climate deniers out there, and if you are a climate denier, you're in the wrong room, please leave as quickly as possible. But what Christy and I talked about earlier this week is that, you know, I just said that the need for zero carbon electricity, the need for clean electricity, but we need to recognize that amongst climate hawks, among people who really want to solve this problem, there is a divide between those who define clean electricity completely equated with renewable electricity. And that is the definition of clean. It has to be renewable in some way, solar, wind, hydro, geothermal, etc. And then there's another camp that says we need to have a broader definition of clean. We need to bring in all sources of low or zero carbon electricity. And that would go beyond the renewables to include things like nuclear and fossil fuel with carbon capture, probably the two biggest sources that when you make that umbrella wider. And, of course, people have very strong views on both of those, but that is a very serious, you know, division among people who want to solve climate. And just to illustrate, I'm sure you know there's plenty of NGOs that advocate 100% renewable. We don't want to talk about anything else. Everything else is too costly or too dangerous or this or that. But when you look on the broader camp of what is clean electricity, you actually see some very important, policymakers are largely lining up on that side. The Biden administration set a goal to produce 100% clean electricity by 2035 using the broader definition, open to nuclear, open to fossil with carbon capture, along with everything else. Any other way you can produce electrons, low or zero carbon, we're in. State governments, you mentioned the important role of state governments. Take a look at the 100% clean goals that have been put either in law or an executive order by 20-plus states. You will see that many of these states have an escalating requirement for renewables, usually through their existing renewable portfolio standard, to get up to 40, 50, 60%, even higher by the 2030, 2035. But almost every state that has gone to 100% changes the definition to the broader definition of clean electricity. When you get to 100%, the state law will allow nuclear, fossil, CCS, anything else that's zero carbon. Just a couple exceptions to this. Hawaii says 100% renewable. Rhode Island, D.C. You can see the pattern here. They're quite small, and in those last two cases, they're part of a larger grid, so they can be 100% renewable within a larger grid. Another very important development that's related to this that many of you have seen just in the last couple months, several of the biggest, most influential, large corporate buyers that have been doing nothing for a decade but buying renewables, stimulating that market, helping bringing costs down, are now saying we are transitioning to buying 100% clean under the broader umbrella. These are companies like Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Meta. Interestingly, Nucor Steel just had an announcement with Google, Microsoft on this. They're realizing it's not enough just to buy renewables and say, well, we have 100 megawatt hours of renewables, 100% of consumption in our company. That's not matching the real time dimension of when they are consuming electricity and what is producing electricity. So in the last couple of years, you've probably seen these big companies moving to 24/7 matching of carbon-free electricity. And therefore, we've seen interesting developments like Google, late last year, entered a PPA, a power purchase agreement, with Fervo to buy advanced geothermal power, 24/7 clean, much higher price than just buying solar or wind. Amazon just announced it has entered a power purchase agreement for much of the output of a nuclear plant in Pennsylvania, because it realizes it needs to go beyond just buying renewable power to 24/7 clean, firm power. And then the final announcement just, I think, last week, I think it was Google, Microsoft, and Nucor putting out an RFI, a request for information on making more purchases of 24/7 clean, firm power. That's what they need to run their factories, their data centers, et cetera. So all these things at the federal level, much of state government, now the large corporate buyers, you're seeing a recognition that we can supply a lot of our clean electricity with solar and wind, but we're going to have to complement it with clean, firm power, hydro, geothermal, nuclear, fossil with CCS. This is a big thing that I want you to be aware of as you move forward in your reporting. And again, there's very strong opinions on both sides of that camp, which we can explore in any depth.
Mm-hmm. So I wanna take a step back really quickly, and then we're gonna segue into some quick slides that are gonna illustrate a lot more about what Carl was saying. This is something that I have a business reporting background, and I've covered this industry from that standpoint. And so I'm frequently reminding people that electric companies in the industry, they're businesses. And that doesn't inherently make them bad people. Businesses exist to make money. but they're also responding to the needs of these other businesses. So again, I'm going to ask Carl to flesh this out, but that we have these large companies like Amazon, like Nucor, which is in heavy industry, Google, Microsoft, they are the ones that are stepping up and now really influencing and telling the electricity industry, you know, we have these clean energy demands. And by the way, we're one of your largest customers, which means we're paying you a lot of money to give us electricity. And that is helping to change this dialogue, or at least shift it in a different direction. Now, as we get into the slides, I want to get into something that where I know there's probably going to be a lot of pushback. I'm probably going to get a lot of pushback, too. But we want to talk about the people who are in the camp that are arguing for this bigger tent, for not just the wind, solar, and storage. And I want to make this clear again. I'm a reporter. I just write stuff. There's stuff. I talk to people, I talk to experts and whatever. I'm not advocating for whatever. I'm advocating that I can breathe better. That's what I'm advocating for right now. But again, we want to really dig into this. Why do we need to broaden the tent, and why do we need to have options? And when I put up this disclaimer about getting pushback is, I know that Carl is going to talk about gas. And even yesterday, a little bit in our training, we talked about just the term. What do we call it? Do we call it natural gas? You know, that's an industry term. Do we call it methane? Do we call it frack gas? What do we call it? Fossil gas. There's this, so for people who are looking at a combination of wind, solar, and storage, which is possible in small amounts, are companies that are doing it like NextEra that have this 24/7 wind, solar, and storage that works for like 4, 5, 6 hours at a time. That is there. But natural gas, or whatever you want to call it, has now become this big flashpoint. So I know that this is going to ruffle some feathers here, but as we get into these slides, I'll have Carl kind of explain based upon the research what we're seeing.
Possible to run large grids all on renewables, but they're going to be more fragile in terms of reliability, and they're going to be more expensive. And it's so important, in my view, that we maintain highly reliable systems. Because if the lights go out, or you can't charge your iPhone, or you can't charge your EV, the political support for combating climate change could vanish. If rates get too high, you don't want to run your electric heat pump anymore. You want your old gasoline car if rates go sky high. So keeping control of costs, keeping electricity affordable is so important, again, to maintain the political support for that challenge of electrifying the economy and getting down to net zero emissions. And if you don't believe me, you don't have to. The messenger is sometimes as important as the message. And that's where I want to draw your attention to this study from 2021, written by 16 authors from the National Renewable Energy Lab out in Colorado, called The Challenges of Achieving 100% Renewable Electricity in the U.S. One of the key conclusions was significant unanswered questions remain regarding moving toward or achieving 100% renewable electricity at a national scale for all hours of the year. There's no simple answer to how far we can increase renewable penetration before costs rise dramatically or reliability becomes compromised. Let's explore why. You don't have to be an electrical engineer to grasp some of the basic principles. This is the figure from that report that I just studied. By the way, I'll make my PowerPoint available. I think I posted it on Vulva, so you'll be able to go into this in detail if you need, but feel free to take pictures too. What the authors did is they said, let's sort of qualitatively describe the degree of difficulty and cost in moving to 100% renewable.
I don't know what I did.
And we'll move from like a fraction of the annual energy from intermittent renewables, solar and wind, moving from 0 to 100%. And what they describe, and by the way, they've identified three zones of difficulty in doing this, cost and difficulty in integrating renewables. And what do we mean by integrating? That's kind of a new phrase that we didn't have to worry about 30 years ago when all of our power sources were controllable, dispatchable, oil, gas, coal, nuclear, whatever. What does integration mean? It means making the intermittency of wind and solar fit together to keep the lights on. How do we do that? We build more transmission by aggregating solar and wind over bigger geographic areas. That means that variability is tamped down by that averaging. We invent cool load shifting and demand response programs to move the load for when the sun is shining or when the wind is blowing. We invent storage, pump storage, lithium batteries, and all sorts of other cool stuff, so we can store when wind and solar is abundant and then use our storage when they're not abundant. Finally, even another integration strategy is just deliberately overbuilding to some extent the wind and solar. Like in the summer, we get a lot more solar generation in the winter just because of the position of the sun and the tilt of the earth. A heavy solar system might have to build to meet that winter load, but then really have too much in the summer. They want to do something with storage, seasonally, plus hydrogen, something like that. So these are integration strategies. They all cost money. Nothing's free. So right now, the U.S. and many countries are in the kind of 20 to 40% wind and solar range, and they say this: we have a short-term variability problem that's largely solved. We have figured out how to absorb huge generation by solar and wind. We use batteries to adjust the frequency, you know, minute by minute as a little bit of solar and wind fluctuation occurs. This is not a problem. We can successfully integrate. Next slide.
Ready?
As we go higher levels of penetration, there's what we call the diurnal mismatch problem, which is just a fancy way of saying the daily problem. We lose all solar generation at night. You know, roughly 12 hours a day, give or take a little bit, you know, winter and summer season. As we move into this kind of 40, 60, 80, we're going to require a lot more storage, a lot more transmission, a lot more of the other integration strategies. Right now, we're deploying a lot of lithium batteries 2 hours. more challenging, and NREL says it's partially solved. Certainly additional research development still needed in Cyprus. Then things get really interesting if you start to approach 100% renewable. They call this the seasonal problem. It's also what I call the Dunkelflaute problem. Anybody know what Dunkelflaute is? It's a wonderful German word. It means the dark doldrums. It means the random but expected rock and solar and wind production, typically during the winter in Germany, but also elsewhere around the world, where just weather patterns have your solar and wind production drop like a stone. That's what we need in the last 10 days, 12 days. It's a real challenge. So, they call this largely unsolved. Again, additional research needed. To get closer and closer to 100%, you need, again, more transmission, you need more load shifting, you need really long duration storage. If you lose a lot of your solar and wind for 10 or 12 days, that's, you know, a heck of a lot of storage, plus the solar and wind capacity to recharge 10 or 12 days after the sun and the wind come back. So this is a really important concept, and this is why, again, mainstream modelers say maybe you can get to 70 or 80% solar and wind, but after that you need clean firm sources to complement that. So you look at the IEA net zero, International Energy Administration net zero pathway. They go to about 70% solar and wind globally, the rest firm sources. The same with the International Renewable Energy Agency, their scenario. You look at the IPCC scenarios from Work Group 3, this last round, typically you have a global energy mix of 60, 70, 80% solar and wind complemented by other stuff. Industrial hydro, nuclear, and fossil fuel with carbon capture and storage. So that's that is sort of the mainstream thing. And, next slide. Final advice from the 16 authors of NREL who spent their whole careers advancing renewable energy: reducing the cost of low carbon generation in the electricity sector, potentially by keeping non-renewable options, including CCS and nuclear, available. This enables electrifying, decarbonizing other sectors, reducing our emissions. So I think I've pretty much covered this. The six assessments report contains similar cautions. You'll see exactly where to find it in the IPCC report. The slides. So the clean firm power we need, and hey, let's also face it. How are we keeping lights on now as we increase solar and wind penetration? Very interesting news article just within the last month. Germany, a leader in the clean energy transition, announced that it was going to have to build 10 gigawatts of natural gas to balance its solar and wind. That's huge. That's how they are integrating, in part, all of their solar and wind. Similarly, California, even at its current solar and wind generation levels, it ordered its utilities, I think about 2 years ago, to go out and buy 1,000 megawatts of clean firm to balance the solar and wind we have on the system. So these clean firm sources that we need, some are commercial, some are at the demonstration stage. And DOE is working really fast on this through the IRA and the bipartisan infrastructure bill to demonstrate what we need. So yeah, hydro, biomass, geothermal, the advanced geothermal technologies that will have a much more broader geographic potential. If we can make hydrogen in big enough quantities, cheap enough, we can burn it in turbines the way now we burn natural gas as a great balancing strategy. We have our existing nuclear plants. If they're safe, we can relicense them. We have various advanced nuclear designs, including small modular reactors at the demonstration stage. And we have natural gas with carbon capture technology, again, pretty much at the demonstration stage. And I particularly direct your attention to what's called oxy-combustion designs, the gas with carbon capture. It's where, instead of having an end of the pipe, almost like a chemical factory to spread it's that, yes, we can transport CO2 by pipeline, and we can inject it into the ground in the right kind of geologic formation, and it does stay. So in those, in that sense, those parts of the carbon capture and storage sequence are demonstrated. We can transport it, we can inject it. And now, sort of flipping the script, so to speak, we are doing some initial demonstration plants on industry and power plants where you capture CO2 out of the exhaust stream, you compress it, you transport it by pipeline or other means to a stable geologic formation and inject it. So, again, this is something that can be part of a mix of mitigation strategies. When you look at the IPCC pathways, when you look at natural pathways, it typically plays a niche role, perhaps a necessary niche in many ways. Like in cement production, there are certain just emissions of CO2 from the processing of cement that we don't know any other way to stop those emissions. So it's a candidate industry for capturing those, compressing, and injecting into the ground.
I should just be fired as a moderator. I forgot. As much as we try to keep this casual, when you all ask a question, please make sure you identify yourself. We want to know who you are and what awesome affiliate you work for. And then, absolutely. So that's funny. I actually asked the CEO of Southern Company, or now he's the retired CEO who loves being the face and the mouthpiece of the industry, like that very question. I said, you know, are electric companies just dabbling in all these different things like hydrogen and carbon capture and saying, well, it's coming, we're developing it, it's not cost effective at scale, code 4, we don't want your bills to triple, even though they still might go up. And I said, are you guys doing all this to pull back and then just say, oh, nope, we're going to stick with natural gas? And, you know, and he, of course, said no. But that segues into my other question for you. How do we as reporters kind of get around, you know, when you're looking at these electric companies? I mean, they've been around for 100 years. Change is hard. Change when you're providing a critical resource is hard. Even look at our own industry. Sometimes I miss those days where you write for the Sunday paper and you file on Thursday and it gets edited and then all the news comes out on Sunday. And we know that we've gone through a dramatic transition. So a lot of times when I hear utilities say, well, we have to worry about reliability. I'm waiting for, with the eclipse and when solar drops, someone, now this would be on a fringe, but to say, well, see, this is why we can't do solar, because the once in, what is it, 100 years? That, you know, so how, when they are putting up arguments talking about reliability, especially in the wake of these climate disasters that we're having, and affordability and things like that, how do we then have a dialogue with them to ask the right questions to get at, are you just trying to do the same thing you've always been doing, or is there a real concern?
I have to answer your question first by saying my heart goes out to all of you in this room as journalists trying to cover the electricity sector, the utility industry, because it is the most fragmented, balkanized, complex, nutty system that probably you'll ever encounter. And in the U.S., it's much more fragmented, balkanized than in any other country, I understand. As you probably know, about a third of the generation of the U.S., maybe a third of customers, I forget how you do it, is under traditional vertically integrated utilities. You know, big chunks of the Southeast, big chunks of the Intermountain West, they have been doing business, kind of like you said, for about the same way for 100 years under rate of return regulation under the PUC. Then you have, since the 90s, you know, we restructured, you know, maybe two-thirds of the country into regional transmission organizations, independent system operators, New England, New York, PJM, MISO, SPP, ERCOT, California. Each of these is different, plays by a different set of rules. There's some unifying characteristics, but in some of them, the generation function has been completely spun off from the distribution companies, from the wires companies. So when you say, like, you know, if you say, like, well, what are the utilities doing in the Northeast? It's like, what do you mean? You know, we have several distribution companies, and we have this whole independent power producer sector, you know, with national companies and sometimes even international companies playing. And then what about like MISO or SPP? Do they spin off generation there? Well, sort of. They spun it off. You have independent power producers, but inside those territories, you still have completely vertically integrated utilities operating. So I've been looking at this for 30 years. I still don't understand it. So how, you know, so, and we can talk about afterwards maybe some of the best primers out there from FERC, WRI, Resources for the Future. There's some, if sometimes your eyes glaze over, I can probably steer you to some materials that can help you get a better grasp on this incredibly balkanized system. Where was I going with this? What do we need to?
I got lost in the alphabet soup, and I've been doing this for 20 years too. So I want to say we're here to answer all of your alphabet soup questions. Also, yeah,
we want them to change their behavior. How do you get them to change their behavior? So do the right thing.
I sit through regulatory hearing after regulatory hearing after legislative hearing after, and so when the electric utilities get pushed on, why are you not doing more wind and solar? What about wind, solar, and storage? What about fill in the blank? And then the typical refrain is getting into reliability. And I will tack onto that, depending upon what region that you're in. For example, a common thing for elected officials, and I'm not trying to make this political, I'm just saying the common thing for elected officials in the Southeast is to, like, point to California and conflate Enron with solar, and there's rolling blackouts, and then they mesh it up with ERCOT and the winter storm, and they say, oh, we don't want to have that happen here, so that's why we just have to keep building. And again, people in their beliefs and all that is on a spectrum. Some of those are fringe. But as we're reporting that, again, how do we kind of push back against that and say, well, what is rhetoric and what is true? Or to boil it down, how do you prevent me from rolling my eyes while I'm sitting in a regulatory hearing trying to cover this?
Yeah. I don't have any easy answers for that, but it's going to require a lot of digging. There are some white hats and black hats, some good and really bad actors in this whole arena, but also often there is a lot of gray areas and a lot of nuanced and difficult and complex issues. In the Southeast, when you have the vertically integrated utilities under the traditional regulatory model, in a sense, everything they do has to be blessed by the PUC. Every line they build, every power plant they build, whether they do or don't do a energy efficiency program, it's all officially, Mother, may I do that? And yes, you may, and then you get cost recovery. Of course, in reality, they are often have tremendous influence over the PUC, or there's revolving doors going on there, and the utilities have much more freedom of action. When you switch to the RTOs and the ISOs in New England, New York, California, et cetera, ERCOT, it's really kind of weird that nobody's really in charge of generation. You set up markets that are going to send out price signals that hopefully people will respond to those price signals, build power plants when needed, but you don't have centralized control over really how much are we building, what kind of things are we building. So it's a much more subtle process of states directing their, like a state in PJM can't control the whole generation mix of PJM, but it can order its local distribution utilities to buy certain kinds of power. And then you look across the whole range of states. Well, some of them are kind of blue states, some of them are purple states, some of them are red states, some of them don't care about climate change, some do. So it's this very complex kind of floating crap game of, where's the generation mix in PJM going, influenced by all those forces, and at the same time trying to keep the lights on. I'll just come back to that point because as you talked about reliability, I just want to give sort of a very personal view. If utilities or IPPs are going to make money off of generation, they want to build more, and they may make reliability arguments. I would take some of those reliability arguments very seriously, again, because we are moving toward a mixture of generation. Where keeping the lights on is more difficult, and if we fail, whether it's due to weather or incompetence or whatever, we are going to lose support for fighting climate change. As you may recall, turn the clock back, when California had a meltdown due to manipulations by Enron, a governor lost his job, and that can happen at the state level or even at the national level if people, rightly or wrongly, are going to blame someone. Oh, it was all that solar and wind that did that. Or, oh, your climate change policies.
I'm going to do one more because I think it's a very critical thing, and then we're going to throw it open one more time. Let's talk about what is happening now. And you're like, okay, what do you mean? Utilities are one of the big things that they do besides provide electricity is that they plan. They're always planning. They're always forecasting. They're always looking at the population change, who's moving in, what businesses are moving in, are people moving in here, what do we need to add power plants, can we stay steady, what types of generation do we need. That's what we've all sat there and talked about. And typically they go to those state agencies once every 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, and they say, here's our forecast. So many of them have gone through that process, and now they're coming back, and they're saying, oh, we thought we needed to build a medium-sized power plant, but now we need to build the equivalent of 20 of them, or of a large nuclear plant, or whatever. And it's one of those, like, you look, you know, kind of like the joke saying, did the lawyer miss the day that they taught law at law school? It's like, was your planning guy absent for 3 years? It's just this, like, what is happening? And there's been countless articles taking a look at this in terms of, right, who missed the mark? What is happening? Is this only going to get into a vicious cycle of where we're trying to get carbon atoms off of the grid, but now we're having to build more? And again, it's at historic amounts. So what? I mean, to me, this kind of came out of nowhere. I know that's not exactly true. At the same time, right?
How did we get here? I think in a sense you can say it came out of nowhere in the following sense. Put yourself back in like sort of spring of 2022. There wasn't much talk about artificial intelligence or spiking demand from the computational needs of that. And we were all kind of wondering, gee, is Biden ever going to get that climate bill? No, it looks like it's dead. He doesn't have the votes. August 2022, Deus Ex Machina, the incredible birth of the Inflation Reduction Act. And that has spurred a lot of manufacturing, a lot of both on-sourcing, not only plans, but shovels in the ground. And then in addition, AI is now truly taking off. All of us have probably played with it. And there's a little, every time we punch, I've heard different numbers on this, but in the old Google search, literally each time you searched, there would be, a tiny fraction of a kilowatt hour would be used in a data center somewhere. When you do a ChatGPT request, it is multiple times the amount of power, fractionally happening somewhere in these vast data centers. I'm going to recommend one other thing to you, absolutely must listen, I think, for all journalists that's related to this, and that is on Dave Roberts Volt's podcast, on February 21st, he had Jigar Shah on from DOE's Loan Program Office. He described in amazing terms the kind of demand surge that is going on. He talked about load forecasts that, in percentage terms, are multiples of what they were just 2, 4, 5 years ago. He talked specifically, about growth driven by Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Apple, Meta. Talked about electric vehicles, talked about manufacturing plants that are springing up at 3 times the rate of, the average over the last 30 years. So this is electric demand growth that really came out of nowhere, in a sense. Nobody could have forecast it just 2-plus years ago. A lot of it is good, the fact that we're having, battery, massive manufacturing plants are going to build lithium batteries, or that we're going to build EVs here instead of someplace else, as well as the other incentives in the IRA to do manufacturing here. Some of it we probably don't welcome. I'm not a big fan of cryptocurrency, but that is also part of driving it too. So in terms of the load growth, the need for clean firm, I really commend that Feb 21st podcast. Great. Kudos to Dave Roberts for that program.
That is a fun one to listen to. We're going to go until 1:05. So let's throw open the floor here. Yes.
think I heard your question right. First I'll say the load growth that we are now seeing now and will continue for many years, I am really concerned that the path of least resistance is to build natural gas plants, uncontrolled natural gas plants, because you can build them fast, fairly low capital cost, and relatively low risk. So as a climate community, we need to make sure that we don't just go on the path of least resistance. On the bigger question, if I heard you right, when Amazon wants or Google wants a big PPA to scoop up clean electricity, who decides? Right now, I don't think we have a decision mechanism like that. The same for somebody wants to locate cryptocurrency place, in Timbuktu. I think it really raises an interesting question going back 100 years of utility law and practices. Like, as you may know the phrase, obligation to serve. When when we grant a monopoly to a local utility, we also put on them the obligation to serve all load in that territory. Well, do we need to rethink that when we have sort of these massive increases? Do we need a more nuanced process to say what additional new load should come in? What is a utility obliged to serve? And just and then a final wrinkle on that, which you'll see in the Jigar Shah podcast, is he forecasts, he believes that a lot of these data centers will just start creating on-site generation and will not be asking their local utility. That's how much they want it, how profitable it is to build that data center. So, again, we may be seeing a lot more on-site generation.
Okay. This has been fun. Let's do one more. Yes.
They are just at the demonstration stage. As many of you probably know, over the last 20, 30 years, we've largely, globally, been building large reactors on the order of like 1,000 megawatts. One development recently is that GE and Hitachi have been marketing sort of a downscaled reactor to 300 megawatts, which is not really an SMR in my mind, but they are having some success in Ontario and I think in Europe and getting some takers. An SMR is really a sort of a radically redesigned reactor to shrink down to, I think most people call it the 50 to 150 megawatt. Don't quote me on that, but it's kind of that smaller range. Different designs need specific approval from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and we have a handful of companies developing those. There's strong interest both on the makers and the utilities that this might be a path forward, shorter lead time, maybe certainly lower initial capital cost, less financially risky to make the big purchase, but how that shakes out with the ultimate cost, average cost of the power, is anybody's guess right now.
I always love putting faces with names. We see all these bylines, and then I'm actually in the room with people, and I'm like, I read all your stuff in the morning. So that's exciting. I hate to end this, because like I said, this is something that I could talk about for a long time. I know you can. This is a very complicated, very, very, very complicated topic. I'm only comfortable with it because I've been doing it for frickin' 25 years, and I'm still learning things. So I say all that to say, thank you for bearing with me today through some stumbles and through both of us, and I will be hanging out for a while to answer questions, and I think Carl will be too. So we can walk you through alphabet soup and utility markets and all these other things. Mm-hmm. We just want to thank you so much. This has been a real pleasure.
Thank you again for that great discussion. Sorry to just cut in there, but wanted to give everyone a five-minute break. 5 minutes. We're starting at 1:10 for our next panel on environmental justice. Thank you. Okay, sorry.
Yes, no, it did. I looked down, and then I was...